Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. The death penalty. It's easily one of the biggest debates in America, even today. Now, those who agree with the death penalty like to imagine that the state never gets it wrong. However, that's just not the case. It is better that 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person be killed for a crime he did not commit. The case of Carlos de Luna is not a lesson in justice, but injustice. It truly lays bare America's broken machinery of death. The term machinery of death comes from Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun, who spent 27 years reviewing and often upholding death sentences. He had come to the conclusion that the potential for error is just far too great in a system which is, quote, fraught with arbitrariness, discrimination, caprice, and mistake, end quote. And while a large majority of people believe that America has the best justice system in the world, the case of Carlos de Luna proves that even in America, an innocent man can be executed. Wanda Lopez was a single mother and high school dropout. Her husband had abandoned her when she was 4 months pregnant with their daughter, and Lopez worked hard to provide a good life for herself and her daughter. She worked the 3 to 10 p.m. shift as a cashier at the Sigmore Shamrock gas station and convenience store. The store was located in a dodgy neighborhood in Corpus Christi, Texas, right next door to the strip club Wolfie's, and flanked by strip malls and fast food restaurants. Working the evening shift, Wanda was used to drunk men coming in and harassing her. Her parents often worried about her being alone in the store, and on occasion, her father would sit in the parking lot and wait until her shift had ended.
Yes, ma'am. I just come to 2602 South Padre Island Drive. I have a suspect with a knife inside the store.
What place is this?
Sigmore.
What's he doing with a knife?
I don't know. He was outside bumming a light off of this guy, and he just told me right now he just came inside the store.
Has he threatened you in any way?
It was a cool night on the 4th of February, 1983. Lopez was all alone in the store. It was approximately 8.09 p.m. when Lopez called 911. Quote, "Can you have an officer come to 2602 South Padre Island Drive? I have a suspect with a knife inside the store," end quote, she said to Jesus Escochia, the 911 operator on the other end of the line. Escochia shouldn't have been answering calls that evening, but only did so because the other 911 operators were busy. "Has he threatened you any yet?" he asked Lopez. "Not yet," she replied, her voice rising with alarm. Quote, "He's a Mexican, standing right here at the counter. Can't talk, thank you," end quote, she said. Escochia questioned Lopez for around 77 seconds, after deducing that she had an attitude. However, towards the end of the phone call, commotion could be heard while Lopez screams, quote, "You want it? I'll give it to you. I'll give it to you. I'm not going to do nothing to you," end quote. Next, Lopez begins screaming before the phone drops to the floor. Moaning can be heard in the background before the line finally goes dead. Finally, Escochia decides to send out a police car to the scene, presuming that a robbery is underway. However, it is already much too late for Lopez. The unidentified man had jumped over the counter and stabbed Lopez. She had been stabbed once through the left breast with a knife. It was with so much force that the blade went through most of her lung, killing her within just minutes. She had managed to stagger outside before collapsing in a puddle of blood. It was later uncovered that Lopez had called 911 earlier on in the evening after spotting the man with the knife loitering outside the store. The 911 operator had told Lopez to call back only if the man entered the store. The crime scene was cordoned off while police began to gather evidence. Lopez's family rushed to the scene after a neighbour informed them that the gas station was surrounded by people and police officers. Lopez's brother recollected that when he arrived at the scene, he spotted two people in the store scrubbing up the blood. Kevin Baker, a car salesman, had witnessed the entire murder unfold. He had been pumping gas into his car in the forecourt as he watched Lopez's final terrifying moments. Initially, he thought that Lopez and the assailant had been playing around. However, when it soon became apparent what was happening, he took a few moments to decide what he should do, before finally making the decision to enter the store. As he began to approach the building, the killer rushed out of the door, threatening to pull a gun on Baker before fleeing north. Baker told police that the man was Hispanic, had dark hair, stood at around 5 feet 8 inches tall and around 170 pounds. He estimated that the man was between 23 years old to 26 years old. Baker said that the man looked like he could have been a drifter. He said that he looked pretty disheveled and was wearing a long-sleeved flannel shirt with a grey sweatshirt. He also said that he had a mustache. Baker wasn't the only witness. George Aguirre had paid for gas shortly before the attack. He told police that as he was filling his car, he noticed a Hispanic man standing outside the convenience store drinking a beer. Aguirre told police that he watched as the man took a knife out of his pocket, opened the blade, and then put it back in his pocket. Aguirre described the man as being mid-20s, around 5 feet 10 inches, with dark hair. He said that he was wearing tennis shoes, a t-shirt, and blue jeans. When he went inside to pay, he informed Lopez of the suspicious man outside and offered to call police. Lopez declined his offer and said that she would call them herself. Years later, Aguirre testified that he had seen the man with the knife enter the store. Due to the time frame later established, it seems unlikely that this was true. It was determined that a significant amount of time passed from when Aguirre left the store and when the killer entered the store. Furthermore, if Aguirre was concerned enough about the man outside, then why would he drive away after watching the killer enter the store? With a description of the attacker, police now had the task of searching the streets for him. Around 40 minutes after the attack, a Hispanic man named Carlos de Luna was arrested for the murder while cowering underneath a pickup truck a few hundred yards away from the crime scene. When he was arrested, he was shirtless and shoeless. His white shirt and shoes were found nearby. There was not an ounce of blood on his clothing or on his body, despite the fact that the crime scene was extremely bloody. Furthermore, de Luna was arrested in the east, while it was reported that the attacker had ran to the north. De Luna was placed in the back of the police car and taken back to the gas station where the crime had taken place. Here, while underneath the dark nighttime sky, both Baker and Aguirre glanced at him through the car window as an officer shone a torch on him and said, yeah, that was the guy they had seen earlier at the store. Next, we will hear from investigative reporters Steve Mills and Maury Posley, who would later cover the story for the Chicago Tribune.
So the police swarm the area and they find Carlos de Luna under a truck. He's not wearing a shirt, he doesn't have shoes on. He's hiding, so he looks suspicious. At that point, they take him back to the scene, and what's a very, very suggestive lineup, you know, the police bring people over to the car and say, is this the guy? And they say, sure he is.
Not a speck of blood was found in his pants, his shoes, and the white shirt that was said to be his.
How could that happen? He's arrested within 40 minutes of the crime, and there's no blood on him.
The story that Carlos told about that night was he was standing across the street. Now suddenly you hear sirens.
He had just gotten out of prison. He didn't want to get violated on parole. Instinct might tell him to run. And maybe the best thing would have been for him to stay.
This case has a lot of indicators that something could be wrong here. And that's what gets you into a case. You sort of open the box and let everything roll out there and just take a look at it and see how it shapes up.
Meanwhile, evidence technician Joel Infante and Detective Olivia Escobedo started to process the crime scene. It was a particularly bloody crime scene with blood throughout the store and out in the forecourt. Inside, Lopez's flip-flops, which had come off during the struggle, were found behind the counter, and a folding knife with its blade exposed was abandoned on the floor nearby. They found shoe prints, a cigarette butt, chewing gum, and clumps of hair, but these were all overlooked. Three fingerprints were found, two on the front door and another on the telephone. However, they were all such poor quality that they were allegedly unusable. There were no fingerprints on the knife, no samples of blood were taken or tested, despite the fact that it was probably likely that the killer sustained an injury himself during the frenzied attack. It took less than an hour for the crime scene to be processed. It was evident that robbery wasn't the main motive. Bills and coins were strewn about and clearly hadn't been taken by the killer. Robert Stange, the store manager, did an inventory after Lopez's and found that $166.68 was missing since the last inventory. At the time, store inventories were pretty simple. Stange did one once a week. He would calculate the total value of the merchandise in store, including gas, plus all of the money in the cash drawer, key safe, and a drop slot safe. He would then see if that week's amount was the same as last week's amount. Throughout the week, Stange would also add to this total bank deposits and credit card sales since the previous inventory. He said that quite often, one week the total would be less than the previous week, and this was due to a number of reasons. Shoplifters, people driving off without paying for their gas, or incomplete deliveries. He said that being down $166.68 wasn't that strange. Moreover, when he was cleaning up the store after Lopez's murder, he found $55 in loose cash. Around half an hour before her murder, Lopez had made a drop slot deposit, meaning that there wouldn't have even been that much cash in the till. It was evident that this was no robbery. Almost as soon as the arrest was made, police officers were publicly congratulating themselves, highlighting the fact that the crime had been solved in less than an hour. But was everything truly as it seemed? On the way to the police station, DeLuna told officers, quote, "I'll help you if you help me," end quote, before he blurted out that he hadn't committed the murder, but he knew who had. He said that a man named Carlos Hernandez had committed the murder. According to DeLuna, he was acquaintances with Hernandez, and he had been sitting in the car which was parked across the street in the bar. He said that Hernandez said he was going to the store to get some cigarettes. He said that after he witnessed Hernandez stab Lopez, he ran and hid underneath the pickup truck, because he was on parole and was terrified of another run-in with police. The cops just laughed. Carlos DeLuna, after all, was a likely suspect. His first arrest came when he was just 15 years old. He dropped out of school during the 7th grade and instead preferred to spend his day sniffing paint and glue. Over his teenage years, he racked up quite a hefty arrest record, for crimes including public drunkenness, disorderly conduct, auto theft and burglary. Then in 1980, DeLuna was charged with attempted aggravated rape and driving a stolen vehicle. He pleaded no contest and was sentenced to 2 to 3 years. He was paroled in May of 1982, and while celebrating his release with a friend who had also recently been released from prison, he was accused of attempting to rape his friend's mother. He broke several of her ribs, ripped off her underwear, and then suddenly fled. While he was never charged with the crime, he was shortly sent back to prison on a parole violation. By December, he was released once again, and following his release this time, he settled down in Corpus Christi and got a job as a concrete worker. Shortly thereafter, DeLuna was arrested for public intoxication, and then 2 weeks later, Lopez was dead. Following De Luna's arrest, he stuck by his story that it was his doppelganger, Carlos Hernandez, who was the killer. The court appointed attorney Hector De Pina Jr. to defend him. De Pina had never worked on a capital case beforehand, so James Lawrence was assigned to the case. Lawrence and De Luna didn't meet until 5 weeks before the trial. De Luna explained to him that he was innocent and that Carlos Hernandez was the real killer. For reasons unknown, De Pina and Lawrence never bothered to investigate the man that their client had named as the real killer. Instead, they left that to the state. While De Luna had a criminal history, his family were adamant that he couldn't have killed anybody. He was extremely childlike, and his sister Rose said that he was even afraid of the dark.
Growing up with him, we had a newspaper route, and we would ride our bicycles and throw the paper. A little chihuahua, no bigger than this, came after us. You should have seen Carlos take off, running. He wasn't a confrontation person. Carlos was afraid of the dark. We lived in the real bad side of Corpus Christi. We never met our dad. Our dad was our stepfather, and he was an alcoholic. We raised ourselves.
His other sisters, Vicky and Mary, said that he was gentle and loving. The book, The Wrong Carlos, detailed how when De Luna was growing up, he often took the blame for his other siblings. He was described as a slow thinker with a short attention span. In school, De Luna had psychological tests which revealed that he had a language learning disorder. As a teenager, it was concluded that De Luna had low average IQ, fine motor difficulty and possible neurological difficulties, as well as a specific learning disability. When De Luna dropped out of school, it was because his classmates had taunted him for his disability. As the trial was fast approaching, prosecutor Steve Schwitz offered De Luna a deal. He pleaded guilty in return for a life sentence. De Luna turned down the deal, again stating that he was innocent. During De Luna's trial, his defense attempted to cast doubt on the state's eyewitness identification of De Luna. The killer had been described as wearing a long-sleeved flannel shirt with a grey sweatshirt, while De Luna was wearing white. They had also argued that there was not a spot of blood on De Luna when he was arrested, despite the fact that the murder was particularly vicious.
Yesterday, De Luna took the stand and told the jury that he didn't kill Lopez, but pointed the finger at a friend, Carlos Hernandez. But as far as the state was concerned, this particular Carlos Hernandez didn't exist.
Try to get some more information out of him about, you know, where does the man live? Has he ever worked anywhere? It was all dead ends.
They have not tried to find this person. They say they've tried, but they have not tried. You know, when I was there in court, I offered to take the lie detector test or any kind of test that District Attorney wanted.
Karen Boudry, Newswatch 10.
Prosecutors derided De Luna's claim that a man named Carlos Hernandez had committed the murder as a lie and contended that Hernandez was a completely fabricated person, a phantom of De Luna's imagination. After deliberating for 4.5 hours, the jury found Carlos De Luna guilty of capital murder and he was sentenced to death. The shock value of the 911 call combined with the eyewitness testimony was seemingly enough to seal De Luna's fate, despite the fact that there was no physical evidence that tied De Luna to the crime scene. De Luna was sent to death row, where he passed his time working in the prison shoe shop, taking correspondence courses in business and writing letters to his family on the outside. In one letter, he wrote how he often cried himself to sleep. As De Luna's execution date was fast approaching, his attorneys filed an appeal on the grounds that De Luna received inadequate legal representation during his trial and that his death sentence was due to racial discrimination. On a vote of 7-2, the US Supreme Court turned down the appeal, which was his first appeal. Quote, "They have never executed anyone on their first date before, but I would hate for them to make an example out of me," end quote, said De Luna. Then on the 14th of October 1986, De Luna was issued a stay of execution. It came around 12 hours before he was scheduled to die. District Judge Hayden Head Jr. said that DeLuna's attorney, Richard Anderson, had raised several constitutional issues that the state did not have time to address before DeLuna's first execution date. His lawyer had argued that the death penalty was discriminatory because killers of white people receive the death penalty more often than those who kill people of color. Lopez was a white woman. The possibility of DeLuna's innocence played no role in his final appeal, which focused on his lawyer's failure to present any mitigating evidence at his sentencing. When this appeal failed, the governor declined to grant DeLuna clemency, and DeLuna quietly accepted his fate. In an interview from death row, DeLuna said, quote, "I don't think anybody can prepare yourself for dying. I can't imagine myself laying down on that gurney. I try not to, but I can't. I'm scared to face this, I'll be honest. I'm only human. Anybody would be afraid to die. I figure if anybody says they're not afraid, they're either lying or stupid," end quote. On the 6th of December 1989, DeLuna's siblings and his nieces and nephews visited him in prison for the very last time. His mother had died shortly after his trial, and he never knew his father.
After Carlos was convicted, I was like a mother figure to him. My last visit with my mother before she died, she looked at me, she promised me something. I said, "Sure, anything. Take care of your brother for me." I said, "Sure, I'll take care of him." And by Carlos going through this, I made myself a promise that I wasn't going to be this uneducated Mexican person. And that pushed me to better my life.
Shortly before 5 p.m., the Supreme Court turned down DeLuna's last-ditch appeal, and then at around 7 p.m., the governor denied his clemency request. He was taken to the holding cell, where he met with the death house chaplain, Reverend Carol Pickett.
In those days, we were executing at midnight. They bring them in early in the morning, and my responsibility, according to the warden, was to be there in the death house, which is in the northeast corner of the unit, which is just only about 50 feet from the house where I lived. My responsibility was to be there when he walked in. I was to be the face that he saw outside of the guards. That was important because every inmate distrusts guards. They have to. They're taught that. They've been abused by them. Not all guards are abusive, but some are. So that was my responsibility to be there. And his charge to me was always, and this was his word, to seduce their emotions so they won't fight, getting out of the cell or getting up on the table. And that was primarily what I was supposed to be. I could be a pastor to them. I could be a minister to them. I could work with them, whatever their religious preference was. But he told every one of them, the first warden did, and all the other ones that followed him that I worked with, which was about six, they would tell him this: "We suggest you talk to him because he's a good counselor. Not, if you don't want to talk about religion, that's fine, but whatever you do, just talk to him."
DeLuna told Pickett that he never had a father, but said that Pickett was the kind of man that he would have loved to have as a father.
When I gave him the peaches and the ice cream, it says here, he said, "Thank you, Daddy. I never had a daddy. You are like my daddy should have been. Can I call you Daddy when I die?" And I told him that's okay. You know, Daddy is so different from Father. It would be a normal thing for a child to say, "Help me, Daddy." Because that's what my kids did. I had a son the same age as this.
He also asked if he could hold his hand as long as possible. Pickett said that he found DeLuna to be childlike.
And he was very, very cooperative. But he was very, very... I don't want to use the word immature or childish. But he was very, very simple. Immediately he began to hang on to me. And I mean that not critically. But he didn't want me to leave. He wouldn't let me leave. And there are certain responsibilities I had to do. Now, every day was, execution day was set aside just for that. It didn't have anything to do with my work on the unit. But there were reports to give to the warden. There were reports to give to the executioners. And there was a time that I would go visit with the family. What he told me about is he never met his daddy. And this was, I'm using the term daddy. Because that's what he used. He never met his daddy. And he told me he was abused by his stepdaddy. Very much abused. He was one of many children. And during the day, before 12 o'clock, he didn't eat lunch. But before the day, he wanted to know if he could call me daddy. If it would hurt my feelings. Because he had never had anybody stick by him who was in a fatherly position. Like he didn't know his real father. He was abused by his stepfather. And I always made it my place to do what I could to make him comfortable. And I felt like if he could call me daddy, that would be fine. It sort of shook me up real bad. You know, I've got four children and three stepchildren and 14 grandchildren, and I know what daddy means. Daddy is a little bit beyond just father. But he was willing to discuss anything after he got permission to call me daddy. And Carlos came in as a quiet, very, very scared. Very, very scared because he was so young. He was basically a child. You know, and that's why I didn't mind him calling me daddy. Because he was just a child. I mean, he had a baby face, he had baby features to me. And when I talked to him, spent all the time with him, I could tell by the way he treated his family, he was crying out for somebody to say, I love you and I care and I want you to listen to me. It was all day long, I was with a boy. I mean, he was a man by age, but he was a boy. And he relied so much on me, and I don't mean that egotistically, but he asked me all types of questions. You know, every time the door would open, what is that? What's going on? Why the phone would ring? And all these type of things. And I would be honest with him. I told him I would do that. And I said, I'm going to do anything you want. Anything you want. But I will be truthful to you. You know, I told him I would do whatever you want. About 6 o'clock, I said, are you sure you don't want anything? He said, well, can you get me something? I said, well, just tell me what you want. He said, strawberries and ice cream and a shake. So I called the Steers Department. They brought him strawberries and ice cream and a shake.
It was Pickett's job as Texas Death House chaplain to prepare the inmates for execution. DeLuna was terrified that the lethal injection was going to hurt, and in a bid to calm his nerves, Pickett read him passages from the Bible.
He was holding on to my hands. My hands were inward, like this, as I believe that Jesus Christ always held his hands. Carlos told me he was a Christian. He registered as a Christian before he got there. So I put mine out. I put them inside the cell. Now, I knew it was against the rules. I knew that the warden found out about it. But I'd been doing this all along. I did a lot of things for inmates that the warden supported me. If they wanted to do it, it would make them more comfortable. And simple things like Dr. Peppers and cigars and all that stuff, that's all in it. But I put him in there, and he was sitting on the cot.
the bunk. And I started praying, and I could feel my hands go down. And Carlos went down, and he was on his knees. By the time I finished the prayer, and it was probably 4 minutes, 5 minutes long, and he was on his knees crying. And he got up, and he said, will you now repeat for me the 23rd Psalm and tell me what does it mean for me right now? So I repeated that, and I explained to him, we're in the valley of the shadow of death, Carlos. And I told him at 10 o'clock where the door was. It's just a few steps away, and what was going to take place in there. And we went through the 23rd Psalm again, and he got back up, and he stood. He didn't let go of my hands. The guards came over there, and you know, they gave me that look, but he knew that we had the right type of guards. The guards never told the warden that my hands were through the bars. I was never permitted to pour coffee for them. I was never permitted to light their cigarettes, which it wasn't legal to smoke down there, but gee, you know, if they're getting ready to die, what's the difference? The warden knew I was doing it.
As Pickett did with all inmates facing execution, he gave DeLuna an opportunity to confess to him and make his peace with what he had done. DeLuna refused, telling Pickett the same thing he had told everybody all along. He was innocent. At around 10 p.m, DeLuna made a phone call to Karen Beaudry, a former TV reporter who he had stayed in contact with after she covered the trial. She asked him if he had anything that he wanted to get off his chest. He told her that he wasn't the bad guy that they all said he was.
Carlos wrote to me and asked me to be the witness at his execution, and I did say no, I didn't think I could do that. But he asked for my phone number, and he said, you know, could I call you sometime? And he asked for my phone number in Ohio, which where I was going to Ohio to spend a few weeks before I started my new job in Georgia. So he had that phone number. So he did end up calling me, I guess it was just about an hour or two before his execution, and he told me that I was his last phone call. And you can imagine getting that phone call from him, and you're thinking, this man is about to die. Why did you choose me as the last person to talk to, aside from the people that obviously you'll be around right there? And then, you know, this overwhelming feeling of, what do I say to this man? How do I comfort him? Should I comfort him? You know, what is my role here? What am I supposed to do? And, you know, it was just sort of a feeling of helplessness, really. But I just let him do a lot of talking I gave him the opportunity, I guess, ever the journalist, I gave him the opportunity to say anything that he wanted to say, perhaps to get it off his chest. If he wanted to admit that, you know, maybe after all this time, yeah, I did commit this crime. I said, Carlos, is there anything you want to tell me? Do you want to tell me anything about what really happened? He said, no. He said, Karen, they're putting to death an innocent man. And then I think at that point it really hit me that maybe they were, because he had nothing to lose at this point. You know, maybe get it off his chest and tell one human being, and he chose me to be the last person to talk with. Why wouldn't he tell me? Why wouldn't he? I'm the person he supposedly trusted, did he want to take it to his grave, or was he really telling the truth? I mean, I found it interesting that, given that situation, that if he was guilty, why wouldn't he just say so? Because of his whole demeanor and the way I had seen him change over the years, I felt it was something he would have wanted to do had he committed the crime. I mean, he had always admitted you know, other wrongs, and the way his life had gone astray, and admitted, you know, getting in with the wrong crowd. And we talked about that a little bit in that last phone call as well. But he never admitted that one crime, for which he was dying for. And, you know, again, what do you say to someone who's about to die? What do you, you know, I'm not clergy. I don't profess to have some great wisdom, but just being someone that had sort of been there and listened to him, I hoped I was somewhat comforting to him, just to talk a little bit and listen to him.
After hanging up the phone, DeLuna and Pickett prayed some more. He asked Pickett to pray that he would remain strong during his last moments on Earth, and that his death would be quick, painless, and he would go to heaven.
But then he got up and he said, I'm ready to go. And he said, I'm going to follow everything you said. And I believe everything you said. And that's the part that caused me to go after we got into the death house. It got even more personal. And that's what was my problem.
Could you describe that?
The telephone rang at midnight. All the guards stayed away from the cell. He didn't want to talk to anybody but me. And we had made that last telephone call to that. We had made calls that night. You know, his family visited in the daytime, and then I went over to the hospitality house to visit them, and they decided they didn't want to visit. They didn't want to witness. And he wanted to talk to them about it and to tell them goodbye. And the family wanted to tell them goodbye. And we worked out a deal over at the hospitality house. Bob Norris was super. That house wasn't built for that purpose, but we've turned it into that. But he called. I got permission for him to call. And like I said, the warden was always, he never asked me, why do you want to do all these things? So he made that call to his family and called to the one sister who couldn't come. And then the call to that pen pal in, I think it's Cincinnati, Ohio. Somewhere up there. I have to look it up. And then after that, it was all just me and him. And he just wanted to talk. And we'd talk about anything. And he would ask me a question, what it's going to feel like, and I told him. I told him it's going to take, from my knowledge, it'll take 9 to 12 seconds for that first medication to go to work. And you'll be totally asleep, you won't feel another thing. And he said, will you be with me, Daddy? He said, I'll be right with you. Will you hold my hand? And I told him before I got in there, I said, there are only certain times I can hold your hand. Only certain times. And this was the only inmate, all of them asked me to maintain contact. You know, or wipe their brow, or don't let anybody see sweat, things like that. But Carlos wanted me to hold his hand.
Shortly after midnight, Carlos DeLuna was led to the death chamber.
Well, they brought him in, and they strapped him down. And I stood right next to him. And he kept looking at me, and kept looking at me. And then the guards left. The guards walked out. And there's nobody in there but Carlos on the gurney. The warden's standing here, and I'm standing here. And he says to the warden, you know, you need to keep the same guards. He said, because this chaplain is great. He's my daddy for today. Well, yeah, I'm churning. So I'm holding his left hand. I agreed to hold his left hand, and I told the warden what I would usually do is I'd have to check their veins. I'm not a doctor. I don't know anything about veins, but they didn't want the executioners to be known. So I checked his veins and asked him if he'd burned them with drugs, and he hadn't. They were good. So I had to go up every night at 11 o'clock. I'd go up and talk to the warden and say, this is what his last words are going to be. This is what to expect. And these are his last requests. And I told the warden, I said, warden, I want to get your permission. You know, he wants to be
his hands to be held. He said, well, you know how it works. Do whatever will keep him from fighting. That was the warden's big concern. So I was holding his right hand, and the executioners, two of them, came in, one big tall man and one short man, and they always started with the left arm, and they put ace bandage around the hand and tighten it down, sometimes tape. Then they would go for the vein right in the middle. And they would, most of the time they were successful. Most of the time. But it's traumatic to watch. And it was traumatic to watch. Because I had told Carlos de Luna, I said, that was going to be the only pain. That's all I had seen before.
When asked if he had any final words, de Luna said, quote, I want to say I hold no grudges. I hate nobody. I want my family to know that I love them. I want to tell everyone on death row to keep the faith up, to keep going. Everything will be all right, end quote. He also thanked Pickett for being his final friend.
I held his right hand. He was squeezing very tight as they inserted the needle. Fortunately, it went quickly. He had previously asked me to stay in touch with him, so I moved down to touch his leg right above his ankle. The needle went in well on the right arm. The sodium tiopentathol began to flow. And he began breathing slowly. After about 10 seconds, he raised up his head and looked at me with those big brown eyes. The warden looked at me and I looked at him. Something was not going right. After about 10 seconds more, he raised his head up again and looked square in my face and my eyes. I just simply squeezed his leg. I don't know what he was trying to say. I wish I did. Nothing was happening. I had told him, I had promised him that it wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't take long. He might have been thinking, you lied to me. I was sick. This bothers me and probably will forever and ever.
De Luna didn't lull into unconsciousness and have a peaceful death like he had prayed for. The anesthetic in the combination of lethal injection drugs had failed, meaning that de Luna was fully conscious and aware as the other drugs took effect. After 15 seconds, he jerked his head up and attempted to speak. 10 seconds later, he raised his head once again and stared directly into Pickett's eyes. De Luna tried once again to speak, but to no avail.
Well, I don't know what he was saying. I wish he'd have said something. If I want to be positive, I'd say the last thing he wanted to say was, Daddy, I'm innocent. Or Daddy, help me.
Pickett was standing at the end of the gurney with his hand wrapped tightly around de Luna's ankle to comfort him, since he wasn't allowed to hold his hand. Pickett held tightly to his ankle as he felt de Luna's heart continue to pump long after it should have stopped. It took Carlos de Luna around 11 minutes to die. It wasn't quick, and it wasn't painless.
After Carlos was pronounced dead, the tie-down team had taken all the straps off and they left. I chose not to leave. So I went over and took him by the right hand and just held him. Just held his right hand with both hands. And I thought, well, maybe I can make it up to him by holding on to his hand as long as possible. And I held on to it until finally I decided it was over.
Carlos de Luna's death marked the state's 33rd legal killing since it renewed the death penalty in 1982 after an 18-year hiatus. While it was the 33rd execution that Pickett had tended to, It was the first execution that he needed psychological help in the aftermath.
And he was pronounced dead 10 minutes after the first stroke. They used to keep records, and they tried to beat 6 minutes. His was 10 minutes. And that's what hurt me, you know, that those 24 seconds were hard. And I had to go talk to somebody about it. I didn't sleep for days. And next time I went to sleep was December 12th. I can remember sleeping on December 12th. I didn't sleep December 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th. That's a long time to stay awake for one kid.
DeLuna had experienced an agonizing death due to the use of pancuronium bromide, a drug which is illegal in Texas for euthanizing animals in the shelter as it is deemed cruel and inhumane. He was awake as the drug collapsed his diaphragm and lungs, and fully aware as the final drug, potassium chloride, shut down his heart.
As we go on, I started seeing mentally retarded people that didn't know what was going on. You know, when a guy's getting ready to die and he says, okay, you know, all I want is my Crayolas and my color book. He didn't know what was going on. And when they started hurting, like Carlos DeLuna, the drugs didn't work. I had to go seek therapy. And I had to go seek therapy because I thought I'd fail the kid. And then it got to be where it became an internal thing, a moral, spiritual, biblical thing. This is wrong.
The final moments of DeLuna's life were forever ingrained into Pickett's memory, and he wrestled with his conscience about whether he had misled DeLuna into believing that his execution would be quick and painless. Quote, "When I saw him die, part of me died too," end quote, said Pickett.
It's wrong. Let's stop it. The public relations officer of TDC said, Texas has never had a botched execution. That's not true. This little old boy right here, do you think he died in 6 seconds? I was there. Do you think that sodium triopentothal, the first drug that they give to him, which was supposed to put him to sleep in 7 to 12 seconds, put him to sleep? Not on your life, it didn't. And I was there holding his leg. He asked me to hold on to him, and I did, like I did for other ones. He was hurting. Then this boy was given an injection of Pavulon. That's the second injection. It used to be used to put animals to death. But the American Veterinary Association has said this is too painful for animals. They have banned it. The third drug is one that freezes the heart. That's the one that killed him. Did it kill him in 7 seconds? 12 seconds? No. 11 minutes.
For Carlos DeLuna, is that 11 minutes?
That's not, to me, either Christian or American or Texan.
Pickett became a strong anti-death penalty advocate. He knew then and there that Texas had just executed an innocent man.
I spent way too many hours, I suppose, listening to their last confession. But some of them I believed. And some of them I checked out. Some of them I found out that they were innocent people. I fully believe Carlos DeLuna was an innocent man. And I will always believe that.
Pickett would later say that he had watched at least 4 innocent men be killed by the state of Texas, as well as numerous others that should never have been executed. He said that a number of those who were executed were fall partners, meaning that 2 or more people were involved with the crime and they were not the one to pull the trigger.
I just wanted people to realize these are people. We were trying to show that one day we're not in a judgment business.
Here's a guy that
paid a man $10,000 to kill his wife. Okay, the man that killed his wife got an 8-year sentence and walked out, and this guy was put to death. And as he died, he was singing a song. And he wanted me to be sure that he died when he reached a certain place in that song. This one right here, a fella who believed in reincarnation. And if I believe him, he is now a tree in Tyler, Texas. Now, like Mr. Holland, he hadn't had a cigar in 15 years. So, you know, I'd ask the warden, I'd go down to the drive-in grocery, buy an Elroy tan, and then put him on the gurney, and they strapped him in, and I stuck it in his pocket. And he just smiled so happy. You know, I'll always remember him just smiling because I stuck a cigar, a little old cigar. Couldn't smoke it, but he put it right in his pocket. Of course, we had to cover it over with the straps. It keeps the chest down. But there's a bunch of little things that people on that day did like, if it made them happy. Or made them make it through the day. This is a man who was out on death row waiting for his execution. He had a stroke, and they flew him down to the prison hospital in order to treat him, to get him well enough to be killed. And when it came time to have his last meal, he couldn't feed himself. So this was the first man that I physically, with a spoon, fed Jerry his last meal.
Now by this time, a lot of people had forgotten about Carlos de Luna. Many just shrugged him off as another inmate feigning innocence in a bid to save his life. After all, the world likes to think that wrongful executions do not happen. They like to think that the criminal investigation is infallible. But there were a few that believed de Luna's claims of innocence, that believed that Texas had executed the wrong guy.
Tonight, a second look at a Texas case raising questions about the death penalty. In the 30 years since the Supreme Court reinstated capital punishment, no state has executed more people than Texas, 367. Now a joint investigation between ABC News and the Chicago Tribune finds that Texas may have put at least one innocent man to death.
In 2006, the Chicago Tribune uncovered new evidence which strongly suggested that Carlos de Luna was innocent. In their investigation, they found that Carlos Hernandez most definitely was a real person. For years, Hernandez's friends and family remained quiet. They sat back while de Luna was executed. But now, they were breaking their silence to support what de Luna had asserted all along, that he was innocent and Carlos Hernandez was the real killer. In fact, Hernandez was well known to police and prosecutors at the time of de Luna's trial, and he had a lengthy police record. He had a long history of violence, which included stabbings committed with a knife that was very similar to the one found at the crime scene.
The knife that's found at the scene, this knife right here, is exactly the kind of knife that everybody who knew Carlos Hernandez said he always carried. They would look at it and say, that's his knife. And he told a half dozen people that he did it and that Carlos de Luna didn't do it.
Long after it was out of the headlines, he was still telling people, I did it, and my stupid Takayo, meaning namesake, took the fall.
Even when you have all of these things that add up to Carlos Hernandez being the real killer, I don't know, we sort of have this give and take where I think I always doubt, are we wrong here? Are we missing something? Is there something that we're seeing the wrong way? This is a very emotional case. I mean, the wrongful execution of somebody, you can't help but be emotional. But you have to be just really, really, really cold to look at it clearly.
Carlos Hernandez was born in Corpus Christi in 1954. He was in and out of trouble with the law throughout his life. In 1971, he was convicted of negligent homicide after he killed his sister's fiancé while driving drunk. His sentence was suspended and he received no jail time. The following year, he received a 20-year sentence for holding up several gas stations. After just 5 short years, he was paroled. Then in 1979, Hernandez was arrested for the brutal murder of Dalia Sokita, who was found beaten and strangled to death in her van. Her sleeping daughter lay by her side. A crude X had also been carved into her body. Hernandez was tied to the crime when his fingerprints were discovered on a beer can inside the van alongside a pair of his boxers. While being held for this crime, Hernandez somehow managed to point the blame towards another man. Prosecutor Ken Baudery, who would later be the co-prosecutor in the DeLuna trial, interviewed Hernandez. Furthermore, Hernandez was taken to the interview room by Detective Olivia Escobedo, the lead investigator in the Lopez murder. Yet at the time of DeLuna's trial, both claimed they had no idea who Carlos Hernandez was, and said he was a phantom of DeLuna's imagination. Astonishingly, Hernandez was once again released, while the other man that he pointed the finger towards was acquitted. In 1986, Hernandez was rearrested for the murder of Dalia Sokita after new evidence surfaced. However, the evidence was somehow misplaced and the charges were dropped. Hernandez was once again a free man. 2 months after Lopez's murder, Hernandez was arrested outside a convenience store with a knife, and then several months later, he attacked his wife Rosa with an axe handle. During the attack, he smashed a window, shattering glass onto Rosa's sleeping children, and threatened to kill her and the children. He was sentenced to just 30 days in jail, during which Rosa filed for divorce. In 1989, Hernandez attacked Dina Yabanez with a 7-inch lock blade buck knife. While he received a 10-year sentence, he was paroled after just a year and a half. Then in 1996, he attacked a neighbor with a 9-inch kitchen knife. 3 years later, Hernandez died in prison. John Kelly, an attorney who represented Hernandez in the late 1970s, said that Hernandez was easily one of the most terrifying people he had ever met. The Chicago Tribune not only interviewed Hernandez's friends and family, but also reviewed thousands of court records. Their findings indicated that the case was compromised by unreliable eyewitness identification, lazy police work, and a complete failure to pursue Hernandez as a potential suspect. After all, the police and prosecutors flat out denied that Hernandez even existed. The investigation also uncovered that Hernandez had bragged to at least 5 people about the murder of Lopez, as well as the murder of Dalia Sokita. Janie Adrian, a neighbor of Hernandez, told the Chicago Tribune that she had overheard Hernandez talk about stabbing Lopez on at least 3 occasions.
Well, I heard Carlos Hernandez once talking about a stabbing or a killing that had happened, but I wasn't really sure who it was or he was talking about, because he wouldn't say names. But when Carlos Hernandez was drunk, he would say things that he's not supposed to have said, that I thought that it was none of our business.
And what did he
we
say?
We didn't have to know.
But what did he say about Juan de Lopez?
That he had stabbed her. But I wasn't really sure. I didn't want to say nothing. So I was afraid if I knew something that he would come. If he knew that we knew more than what we supposed to have heard. When he was drunk, he wouldn't really care. But when he wasn't drinking, you know, he would say sometimes, oh, well, how did you hear that? Or, you know, I didn't say it. Or, I was drunk.
How many times did you hear that?
But 3 times.
Dina Yabanez also told the newspaper that Hernandez had confessed to killing Lopez to her and her husband. Both women said that they were too afraid to come forward earlier, particularly Dina, who had been stabbed by Hernandez in the past. She said that during the attack, he had threatened that he was going to kill her like he did to the other woman. 2 other women, Beatrice Tapia and Priscilla Jaramillo, were just young girls when they heard Hernandez confess to the murder. Jaramillo was Hernandez's cousin, and she had been living with his mother.
Priscilla, you said when your Uncle Carlos and your Uncle Javier were up on the porch, they were talking about Carlos having hurt someone. You mentioned the name Wanda. You said he had something in his hand. What was that?
Well, Carlos had a habit of carrying a knife, a pretty big knife. It wasn't a small little pocket knife. I mean, it was a pretty good-sized knife, thick knife. So that's what he had.
How often did you see him with a knife?
Well, he carried it around all the time.
Was he proud of that knife?
I believe so. I mean, he carried it in his back pocket all the time. He never left home without it.
One afternoon, she and Tapia overheard Hernandez speaking to his brother about the murder shortly after it happened. Jaramillo was too terrified to tell anybody about what she had heard because Hernandez had molested her in the past and she was scared of him. The Chicago Tribune also managed to track down Miguel Ortiz, an acquaintance of Hernandez. He told the newspaper that Hernandez had openly confessed to the murder to him. The Chicago Tribune even spoke with a former detective named Eddie Garza, who said that before the trial, he had received tips about Hernandez.
Carlos Hernandez was involved in many crimes that weren't ever even brought to an investigation. I mean, that Salcedo case, God, that'll tell you everything right there, the kind of killer that he was.
Escobedo knew who Carlos Hernandez was.
She knew who Carlos Hernandez was. She disregarded what we were trying to tell her.
Is this a case of tunnel vision where, you know, they dragged the guy out from under a truck?
We got 40 the guy.
Trains left
we
the station.
We got the guy. They arrested him. He's hiding underneath the car. This is the guy. Where are the fingerprints from the door? Where are the fingerprints from the knife? Where are the fingerprints from the cash register? Where's the fingerprints if any money was there? So in this particular case, Carlos Hernandez got Carlos de Luna to take the fall for him. That's the way I feel.
He said that he had heard from informants that Hernandez was openly bragging about the murder. As a detective, Garza knew both De Luna and Hernandez and said that the crime seemed more like something Hernandez would do, not De Luna. Garza said that he passed the information to Olivia Escobedo, the detective leading the investigation. Escobedo, however, claimed she never received such tips. While Garza claims he knew about Hernandez, he still testified at De Luna's hearing and told the jury that De Luna had a bad reputation. Next, we will hear from De Luna's sister, Rose.
It's just sad to hear all these things that everybody talks about, that my brother wasn't capable of doing all this, but they still executed him. Nobody ever listened. They just wouldn't listen. And even when my husband and I hired an attorney, they didn't even help us. Now, 19 years later, we're saying, oops, we could have made a mistake. So now what? And knowing what I know now, if God would ever give me a second chance and knowing that I can go back, I would fight harder for Carlos. And not just listen to these attorneys that we hired. On his birthday, he would have been 44 years old. March 15th, every year. Think about Carlos. It's a real painful situation to go through every year to think about him.
In 2012, the Columbia Human Rights Law Review released a 400-page report which detailed the events of De Luna's trial and stated that he had been wrongfully executed. Columbia Law School professor James Liebman and his students had conducted the study as a contribution towards a public debate on the death penalty. They specifically argued that it is an ineffective form of punishment. The group decided on covering the De Luna case after Liebman did a study on courts across the United States and how they handled legal error. The Columbia study asserted that it was Hernandez who committed the murder, not De Luna. Quote, On evidence we pulled together on this case, there is no way a jury could have convicted DeLuna beyond a reasonable doubt, but they could have convicted Hernandez beyond a reasonable doubt, end quote, said Liebman. The Columbia study took 5 years of investigation to complete. He wrote that every single thing that could have went wrong in a case did, and that the wrongful arrest of DeLuna was made specifically to avoid a departmental embarrassment for the 911 operator not responding to Lopez's first call for help. The Columbia study went on to turn their findings into a book named The Wrong Carlos, Anatomy of a Wrongful Conviction. In the book, they described an interview their private detective had with Kevin Baker, one of the eyewitnesses.
How certain were you that night?
Probably 70%. It wasn't 50-50, it was more. But I will say this, one of the police officers did mention to me, we found this guy hiding underneath the car without a shirt on. Two blocks north of us.
If they had not said that, would you be less than 70% sure?
Yes.
Okay. Where would you say you'd be if they hadn't said that?
It would have been a 50-50.
According to Baker, he was only around 70% sure that DeLuna was the man he had seen at the gas station, adding that he found it difficult to tell Hispanic men apart. Baker told the detective that because he was unsure, he thinks that the officers eased his uncertainty by telling him that DeLuna was found hiding under a pickup truck. He said that if the detectives hadn't have told him that, then he would only have been around 50% sure that DeLuna was the man at the gas station. In the wake of the Chicago Tribune investigation and the Columbia study, many questioned whether a truly innocent man had been executed. Former District Attorney Grant Jones, who sought the death penalty for DeLuna, has since changed his stance on capital punishment. Quote, I can't answer the question if a mistake was made, but if it was, then an innocent man was executed, end quote. He refused to talk about DeLuna specifically, but said that, quote, the problem with the death penalty is once it's carried out and there is a mistake, you can't go back and correct it, end quote. The prosecution, however, say that they still believe that they executed the right man. Although the lead prosecutor, Steve Schwitz, acknowledged that he was troubled by some of the new information, he said that if he had been informed by a fellow prosecutor that Carlos Hernandez was a real person and a suspect in another murder, then he would have investigated him. In May of 2012, legislative sponsors of a law which would tighten procedures for police faulted the Corpus Christi police for allowing the eyewitness to identify DeLuna as he sat in the back of a police car. State Senator Rodney Ellis and Representative Pete Gallego stopped short of saying that Texas had wrongfully executed DeLuna, but they made their point. They said that how the identification of DeLuna took place was a textbook example of why the system needed reformed. Quote, what appears to be very faulty eyewitness identification was the main evidence used to reach a conviction in this case, end quote, said Ellis. A suggested reform plan requires that the police officer conducting the lineup does not know who the suspect is. It is also required that in show-up identifications, wherein the police officer presents a suspect to a witness shortly after the arrest are discouraged, and that the photo or live lineups must contain innocent people who resemble the suspect. Quote, there is no darker stain on the criminal justice system than wrongful conviction, and a wrongful execution is the darkest stain of all. The idea behind our bill was to try and ensure we did everything humanly possible to minimize the danger of wrongful conviction, and the lion's share of those cases come from errors in eyewitness identification, end quote, said Gallego.
The system's broke. But no man should die alone without a friend. I think that's what I was. 2 weeks after I retired from the walls, changes were made. Now they bring them in at 4, feed them, shower them, and 6 o'clock, it's time to kill him. There would be no way in the world that any chaplain could be effective. The man wouldn't have time to get ready to die.
Sadly, the case of Carlos de Luna is not an isolated one. 3 decades have passed since de Luna was executed, but the flaws that condemned him still reverberate in the criminal justice system today. Faulty eyewitness testimony, a quick-to-convict police force, lousy legal representation and withholding of evidence. America is the outlier among industrialized nations, and it is the only country in the New World that continues to execute prisoners. Whether or not we agree with it, the death penalty is an extremely flawed system, even today with the advancement in DNA technology, and we still don't know how many others, just like Carlos de Luna, may have fallen through the cracks to their unwarranted death without ever being noticed. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, I'd like to thank you so much for listening. I'd also like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreons, Ray J and Sandra Shufford. Morbidology is a one-woman podcast, so the support really does go a long way in helping me cover the costs of hosting, producing, researching, and all that important stuff that goes into making a podcast. So if you're interested in ad-free episodes, early release episodes and articles, and other goodies, make sure you check out Morbidology on Patreon. I'd also like to thank everybody that has taken the time to leave a nice review on iTunes, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, shared an episode, commented on an episode. We really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Hey, this is Stephen Pacheco, the host of Trace Evidence, a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. Each week, I explore a different unsolved case and take a deep dive into the victim, the events leading up to the crime, every fact we know, every question we're left with, and then a breakdown of the most popular theories revolving around that case. Each Monday, a new episode comes out, and there are more than 80 episodes of mysterious and fascinating cases to catch up on, some you've heard, and many that you haven't. If you're drawn to deep examinations of some of the most mysterious cases, give Trace Evidence a listen. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcatchers. Visit trace-evidence.com for more information, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Hey, true crime listeners, check out our podcast, I Said Goddamn. We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by two besties who like to share messed up cases that make you say goddamn. Every Sunday, we try to one-up each other's story by sharing a horrific case the other has never heard of. Along the way, we splash in some wildly inappropriate jokes and colorful language. Listen every Sunday from any of your favorite podcast directories. Also, follow us on Twitter at ISGDPodcast or visit our website, isgdpodcast.com.